This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. District Council 37 is the city's largest union of municipal employees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. I'm Chris Policano. This show is also now a podcast, which means if you're on iTunes and you go to the podcast app and you search for DC 37 State of the Union, you will find this show and you can hear it that way if you can't be by your radio at 8 o'clock on Sunday evenings. Tonight, we are joined by Local 983 President Joe Puglio, who represents many city parks workers, and we're talking about a recently introduced state bill that the union has pushed, which proposes to raise the penalties for certain serious crimes committed in city parks. The goal is to deter serious crimes from being committed against our members and against parks workers. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Chris. Okay, correct. The bill that we helped push under Assemblyman Lenthal would assure not just parks employees, our members, but also the general public. Basically, what it is a sanctuary bill that would give minimal penalties for high-level crimes such as rape, murder, manslaughter, assault, that it would make sure...
It would give them the max, no?
Yeah. Unfortunately, when people commit crimes in our parks, serious crimes in our parks, the judges have the discretion of going below the bar and give them lesser penalties than what they deserve.
So basically this law says if you do anything against the law in our parks, you will have to spend the maximum amount of time. Is that how that goes?
Yeah. They can't. Yeah. That like for example, something like manslaughter would be.
These are serious crimes.
Yeah, these are serious crimes. It would be a minimum of 6 years in jail, where judges have the discretion, if they chose so, to make a crime like that 6 months. So if you commit a crime in a park, you will definitely get a lot more than you would have if you're just outside across the street.
So I misspoke earlier. This is not just about if you attack a parks worker.
This is anybody. And this is similar to what's at our schools right now, the drug-free zones.
Yes.
That if you commit certain crimes around the schools, that you'll get a higher penalty for being in that area. And don't forget, just on school children alone, they don't only go to parks. They don't only go to schools. They go to parks as well. And that's a place where we should feel comfortable. We should not have to worry about, people assaulting our children, our seniors. The way I like to coin it is you shouldn't have to feel like you're riding the subways at 2 a.m. when you're out with your family on a Sunday in the park.
I am old enough to remember when Central Park was the object of scorn and ridicule by late night talk show hosts about getting mugged in Central mm-hmm. Park. Mm-hmm. And that was, I'm talking about the 70s and 80s. There has been great progress made in reducing crime in city parks. I mean, let's be clear about that, correct?
Yeah, park overall in the city, right, has gone down dramatically. Unfortunately, crimes in our parks have not gone down as much as they have outside the parks. Crime, continues to be prevalent, unfortunately, in our parks. A lot of people that are committing these crimes feel more comfortable in the parks because of seclusion and people have their guards down.
Does the city employ enough parks enforcement officers?
Unfortunately, not. You know, the numbers have gone up, and we attribute a lot of this to the mayor, who's done a great job actually when it comes to parks enforcement. That's not to say that we fulfilled our needs, but he has taken a serious attention to the matter, and we have gotten a couple of hundred more people as a result of his budgeting.
And we did a story in the Public Employee Press I think it was like a month ago, on the mounted urban park rangers who patrol the parks on horseback. Talk about the work of the urban park rangers a little bit, if you
will.
Well,
the urban park rangers were established in 1979. They were a novelty, to say that they were, implemented in our New York City parks as sort of a pilot program to see how they would work out. So there was no clear job description for them. So what they would do is they would give out tours to the parks and teach ecology and, bird watching, take out school children, and at the same time try to do law enforcement work at the same time. And what they found out is you can't do both at once. So they separated the ones that did education, and they separated to another group that would just do enforcement. So that's how we now have the PEP officers, the Parks Enforcement Patrol officers. They're specifically geared for a crime. And then we have, of course, the rangers who still continue to do the traditional educational functions of and stewardship of the park.
How many are there?
Unfortunately, we're not equally balanced with the educational portion as we are with the law enforcement portion. We only have, I believe, currently 35 rangers that do the education portion. We're looking to get, and hopefully city council will give us 50 additional rangers this year so that children and other interested people in parks could take advantage of their tours and what they have to offer.
And I'm just curious, you're out in the parks a lot, aren't you?
Yes.
And I think I've asked you this before, and I don't remember what the answer was, but what's your favorite park?
Well, it's hard to pick just one park, being that, I've been to just about every park in the city of New York. But I would probably have to say probably Central Park.
Okay.
Because that's where I first started to work, and that's a park that when I first started there, seemed so big, so vast that, it seemed endless at the time. And slowly but surely working there, I got to know just about every inch of that park.
Is there a surprise park? Is there a park that was, like, off the beaten path that you, have been blown away? Like, I didn't even know this was here. And this
well,
is really
even
great...
inside, let's talk about Central Park. Even inside Central Park, there's the North Woods. Mm-hmm. And there's like a little waterfall in there that a lot of people don't know about, that they just stay on the main drives and don't venture on. And unfortunately, you probably don't go there because of the fear of crime. And that's, what we're here talking about, that people should not have to be fearful of seeing, these treasures, inside our parks because of their isolation and fear of being assaulted.
Are you talking about, because I used to live up by 106th Street.
Yeah, that's right around that area, right there on the east side.
Some beautiful.
Between 110th Street and 96th Street, there's a whole hidden treasure in that area. You have Conservatory Gardens, which is right there on 104th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes all the way up to the Dana Center, where the Hall of Mirrors is. You know, that's a lot of unexplored, you know, territory for most people.
And then further up is the ice skating rink.
Yeah. That's right around that area, at the tip.
Have you been following any of this about the potential park conservancy? There seems to be the changes taking place, management changes. There were layoffs, I understand.
Overall, the conservancies started off actually in Central Park, you know, with the best of intentions. Because back, like when you said, in the 70s and 80s, you know, a lot of these parks were very dilapidated. You know,
the fiscal crisis.
Yeah, the fiscal crisis. You know, the things were bad. You know, everything was bad in the city of New York. And a lot of these parks needed, you know, money. And these conservancy groups, with the best of intentions, got together. This was a grassroots operation, and they funded Central Park, and they did a lot of wonderful things. And as time went on, the program spread, and it wasn't just Central Park. They started going into downtown parks, and then in Brooklyn, and now in Queens. The only problem with these conservancies is that it's private funding. You know, the funding could end, like you said, anytime. These workers are not union workers. You know, they could be laid off at any time, and they don't have the benefits and privileges that our members have. And in a way, you know, we feel, you know, that they're being exploited, you know, for the sense of saving money. You know, it's become, you know, a tale of two workers.
Right. There is the city worker who has the union benefits, and these folks at the Central Park Conservancy who are not labor, who are not represented by
exactly.
Union.
And we don't see them as the enemy. We just see them as people that are exploited. You know, that could do better. That could have, hearing rights.
All right, let's go back to this bill for the remaining part of the show. We've only got about a minute or so left. This is the Crime-Free Parks Law. It has been introduced by Assemblyman Lentol,
correct.
Joseph Lentol. And where does it go from here?
The Senate, and I had spoken with Diane Savino, and she's eager to present it to the state senate.
But the session ends on June 30th. We're not talking about being able to do this by in the next 21 days, are we? I mean, this is...
I believe so.
Oh,
I
good.
According to Joe Lentol, he sees it as a possibility. He's optimistic with it, so...
All right. Well, Joe Puglio is the president of Local 983. It's always great to have you on talking about the parks. The parks are a city treasure, and we'll follow this crime-free parks law, and we'll be back.
Thank you.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. And we're also available as a podcast on your iTunes. Just look at the podcast app and search for DC 37 State of the Union. Our next guest is author Jonathan Rosenblum. He has written a book called Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. Welcome to the program, sir.
It's great to be on. Thank you very much.
Now, the Fight for 15, there is a case to be made that the Fight for 15 began in the Seattle-Tacoma area, and that you were part of that movement, which is stretched across the country. Last year, we had the mayor announced and the governor announced that state and city workers would have a $15 minimum. And so it is a movement that has had an impact. Let's talk about why you wrote the book and where it began, the Fight for 15.
Sure. Well, I actually have to start out by giving props to the New York City fast food workers. They were the first ones who actually raised the banner of $15. And when they went out, left work for a day in November of 2012 and demanded $15 in a union from Burger King and KFC and other fast food companies. And at the time, I was the director of the SeaTac Workers Airport organizing campaign out here in Seattle, Washington. And the workers that we were working with, these are baggage handlers and fuelers and cabin cleaners and the like, low-wage, minimum-wage workers working for contractors under abusive conditions, they saw what was going on in New York, and they took a lot of inspiration from our brothers and sisters back in your city. And they said, you know, we should be demanding the same thing, too, here in Seattle.
And so tell us a little bit about that struggle.
Well, the campaign here began as a campaign to organize and build power for the 4,000 low-wage workers at the airport. And these were, as I mentioned, people caught in these cycles of poverty working for a series of minimum-wage contractors that were in turn hired by the airlines. And, you know, if workers ever started organizing at one of the contractors, the airline would simply replace the contractor and effectively fire the workers. So the campaign started with this idea of we need to organize everybody at the airport, not just people at one company or another company. And in 2011, workers began to organize and began to demand safety training and equipment and fair pay and fair treatment and so on. And it really galvanized in 2013 when the workers went to their various bosses and said, we have formed unions and we demand that you sit down and bargain with us to improve conditions. And if you don't, we're going to go to the voters and have them impose a contract on you. The employers all said no, including the leading airline at our airport, which is Alaska Airlines. They're headquartered here, and they're the dominant carrier by far. They and their contractors all said no. And so at that point, workers and organizers and community allies went out into the community, collected signatures, and put what became SeaTac Proposition 1 on the ballot. And that included not just a $15 minimum wage, an immediate 15, by the way, no staging in, 15 paid sick leave, full-time work if it was available, protection to keep for people to keep their tips, and also job protection if the airline decided to change contractors, the workers got to keep their jobs. And that's the initiative that ultimately went to the ballot and passed in November of 2013.
Is there something unique about the Seattle-Tacoma area that there was so much support among the community folks?
I don't think there's anything that was unique. I think what was important is that people realized that we're all in this together, that this community was so dependent on the airport economy that we couldn't simply just organize the workers, but we had to organize and unite small business owners in the area who stood to gain if workers were making more money, people who were active in the community, because so many of the workers themselves participated in faith communities, churches, but especially mosques, that the leaders of faith communities played a vital role in lifting up this campaign. So it ultimately became not just a union organizing campaign for a specific group of workers, but really a campaign to win the economic and social liberation of a community.
And this is also happening because I try and make the case on this show as often as possible that everything is connected, and that things grow out of other things. And it seems to me that this is around the time that the inequality movement, the Occupy movement, has raised the issue of inequality to the point that everyone is talking about it, everyone is thinking about it, and maybe that's resonating as you're doing, as the airport workers are doing their thing. Is that a fair assessment or not? Am I off base?
No, that's absolutely a fair assessment. And I know there's been critique of the Occupy movement, that what did it accomplish? And yet I can tell you that here in SeaTac, some of the best activists and leaders in the campaign were people whose political credentials were burnished in the Occupy movement, who became active as a result of the Occupy movement. And in fact, there was this great scene that we had on our campaign where you have the occupiers in downtown Seattle, you know, mimicking what you and others did in Zuccotti Park. And the Muslim leaders come to them, and this is a decidedly non-Muslim group at the Occupy Center. And the Muslim leaders come and say, you know, it's great that you're here. We're here in solidarity with you, but you need to come down to the airport.
Well, I mean, it's just clear that it's because, as you said, there has been criticism of what did Occupy accomplish. And I think Occupy accomplished a great deal in terms of raising that issue and bringing it out to the forefront and leaving and making it. You know, you couldn't ignore that issue after the Occupy events that took place across the country. And I just thought that, you know, without that kind of basis, and organized labor has for years tried to make this case, but something very special happened with Occupy, and was organic, and it was spontaneous, and it grew. And I just, go ahead.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. What Occupy did that was so vital is it named the problem as capitalism, that this is not the problems that we have in society today, whether it's wage inequality or civil rights abuse or lack of housing and so on. There's a common root to it, and there's an analysis that we need to have that says what's happened here is not an accident. It's an intentional design. And in fact, in my book, I go through how the inequality at the airport here in SeaTac mirrored the same inequality growth at airports New York to the West Coast, where you have, beginning in the 1970s, deregulation, changes in bankruptcy laws that, by the way, were instituted under Democratic administrations when Jimmy Carter was in the White House, that allowed airlines to basically break union power in the airline industry, contract out work, bust unions, walk away from pension obligations, and that this was part of a strategic plan that the airline industry had. And if you look at other industries in our country as well, other parts of the economy, you could see the same thing, the same intention year over year to break worker power and to realign power in the economy so that workers had very little and bosses could call the shots. And what Occupy did is it reminded all of us that this is part of an intention by business and political elites, and that if we want to turn it around, we have to organize.
We're talking with Jonathan Rosenblum. He's the author of Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. Jonathan, how are we getting the book? How do we get the book?
Well, you can get the book at your local bookstore. I know it's also carried by the big nationals, like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but I highly recommend you check out your local independent bookstore, or you can buy it online. My website has a link to all the places you can buy it. It's jonathanrosenblum.org. And if you go there, you can actually buy it from out here on the West Coast. Powell's is a union bookstore with ILWU members running the bookstore. You can buy it from them. You can buy it from Beacon Press, my publisher, or any number of places. And again, go to jonathanrosenblum.org.
Just want to make clear.
Check it out.
Just want to make clear that Rosenblum is spelled R-O-S-E-N-B-L-U-M. So where do we go from here?
Well, you know, I'm really inspired by a lot of the movements that are flourishing at this point, and I know that we are all extremely challenged by what the Trump administration is doing, and not just Trump, but the people around him and the corporations that are taking advantage of this moment to try to exploit workers in unprecedented ways. But I'm extremely inspired by the reaction, first of all, the mass reaction to the Muslim ban. Here in SeaTac, we had thousands of people come to the airport on a moment's notice, take over the airport, shut it down at moments, and demonstrate mass resolve to fight this inhumane order from the Trump administration. And then we were totally stoked to hear about what the taxi drivers did at JFK, basically stopping, having a strike to show resolve. And I think workers coming together and taking collective action have tremendous power. And we have to remember that in this moment. And that's the sort of thing that we're going to need to do moving forward. There were a number of tremendous actions during May Day, immigrant rights marches and so on around the country. But we need to build on this stuff. I'm very inspired by things like the Moral Mondays movement coming out of North Carolina, the Reverend William Barber fusing faith and social action together in powerful new ways. And these sorts of movements that we see percolating up around the country are things that we need to support and then knit together into a big mass movement.
Thank you very much. Jonathan Rosenblum is the fellow that we've been chatting with about his book, Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. If there's anything about the conversation you want to weigh in on, State of the Union at dc37.net. And once again, you can find out more about the book at Jonathan Rosenblum, that's rosenblum.org. Jonathan, thanks for being on the program.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Okay, before we go, we have several announcements. The DC 37 Organizing Department is holding lunchtime meetings at various sites and dates citywide to remind you to vote no this November on the ballot question regarding the state constitutional convention. For more information about these meetings, please call 212-815-1095. And if you're interested in erasing your federal student debt, find out how by attending a workshop Wednesday, June 21st at 5:30 p.m. at Union Headquarters. You can register online at www.dc37.net/student-debt. And the Municipal Employee Legal Services reminds you that they provide legal representation to members when applying for citizenship. For more information, call 212-815-1818. Anything that you've heard on this show that you want to comment on, please send it, drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Stay with us on social media, and always visit the website, www.dc37.net. Before we go, I want to thank our guests, Local 983 President Joe Puglio and author Jonathan Rosenblum, for joining us this evening. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.